Okay, Steve?
A couple of things. One, though a number of things have been implied, I think they should be stated specifically. First, if you go into business with the expectation of making a profit, you have 5 years. IRS expects to see a profit 3 out of those 5 years. If you can establish that, you have tax deductions. No law says that you have to make a profit the first 2 years, and if you're on the air for 2 years, that's a good run for a lot of people. If you don't do that, then you do not have deductions because the IRS does consider it a hobby. So I think that's a very important line to draw. Therefore, if you're on a non-commercial station, which does not pay for the use of the material, you cannot charge off the expenses in creating the program. You have no expectation of making a profit, unless the program is syndicated, in which case money comes from that. It seems to me that given the tax laws, that the radio stations themselves, but let me add one other point, that the airwaves are under such tremendous pressure to produce the maximum amount per available channel in profit because of the limited number of stations available, because you cannot create more space on the band, that you do keep getting these format changes. So it seems to me that the entire structure of what passes for public radio has got to be reconsidered. If you want a minority interest broadcast system, it should be established through a commercial station which has some of its ordinary expenses underwritten in some way from some kind of fund where that contributes significantly towards making the station profitable enough to keep it available to people with minority programs. There's got to be some structural change to either match that, or there has to be a change in the tax laws which go far beyond our own particular interests in this.
Well, one thing that public radio stations are doing, my own WAM, UFM in Washington quite successfully, is selling underwriting of various kinds. Corporations are allowed to underwrite programming that's structured over various ways throughout the broadcast calendar year, in which they are allowed to get their name mentioned and some function of the service that they perform without any kind of comparative statements. We are the best used car dealer, so on and so on, or anything that suggests that there's any compulsion from us to you to buy. That's resulted in quite a bit of income for us. We have also encouraged local people that individually support the station to make larger bequests to us of $200 and up, and for that they're able to get their own personal messages of sponsorship of underwriting on there as well. And so it's one way that public radio has moved a little bit into the commercial arena by doing that without having outright advertising. As far as, and I was out talking to Rich Marco about this too, because I should apologize, between us we kind of dropped his question there that he had earlier. As far as trying to get minority-based material on commercial radio, I think there probably are instances in places where that kind of thing can be done successfully, but I think it requires a commercial sponsor with an interest, a specific interest in the kind of minority music that you're doing anyway, because I don't think anybody is going to come out and do that on a pro bono basis on commercial stations, with two exceptions. It works for rock and roll, it works for classical music. I'd like anybody to tell me if they find it working for anything else on commercial radio in 1989.
Well, usually, though, when you have a specialized program like that, you can hear it Sunday morning about 6 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. and that's one of the problems with that. They have a conscience, but they also have a pocketbook that needs to be filled.
When we, I mentioned before about the big discussion that's happening with public radio, and it deals with survival of public radio, and that is expansion and diversifying the system. One of the ways for doubling the audience, whatever that term might mean, is to, with the shift in the demographics and the population, I guess we'll see in the 1990 census, is to like try to appeal to more minority audiences. And because when you listen to public radio across the country, there is very little minority programming on. And I guess to be able to present it in an intellectual and highly produced situation is, I guess, is going to help expand the system. At least that's the way I see the system expanding and diversifying. But like Carlos said before, within the realms of independent producers, that means that somehow there's going to have to be a mechanism put in place to train these high-tech minority independent producers.
Let me interject just one thing, because I want to see Gerald Gibson stand up there for a while. But I think there's also a current that we're swimming against, and that is the change in public radio programming philosophy away from small blocks of specialized programs, hour-long blocks, into seamless programming, where you have long stretches of classical music or blues or jazz or country western. They want to stretch things out so that they can hold their audience. And there's, of course, a philosophical debate within the community that perhaps you'd be better to prepared to expound upon, as you're a little higher up on the ladder than I am. I'm just a lowly producer.
It's called war.
Jerry?
Thank you, Carlos. I'm Jerry Gibson from the Library of Congress. I'd like to, raise one point of disagreement, or at least question, about classical music apparently being available in most of the audiences in this country. I happen to like classical music. It's my preference. I find it difficult outside of major metropolitan areas to find classical music available on the public radio or on radio that I'm listening to in most cases. Now, maybe I'm not looking in the right place, but if you can tell me where to put it on the dial to find it, I'd appreciate it. A point of information from an institutional, and I would think from a broadcaster production standpoint. I don't have the citation with me, but I believe the U.S. copyright law makes a significant distinction between public radio and commercial radio. If you come to the Library of Congress and say you're producing a radio program for public radio, we do not require written authorizations from the owners of commercial recordings. If you tell me or imply or it becomes clear in the conversation that you want copy for a commercial program, you must get written authorization before I'll provide you copy at any cost. Now, if you're interested in that, either from the institutional standpoint or from a producer standpoint, if you contacted Sam Wolowski, who's the senior reference librarian for sound recordings at the library, and asked him for a copy of the library's policy statement on providing materials for public broadcast purposes, he can provide it with you and the citation. But it is a formal policy at LC now.
That's very right. I have 2 points to make to Jerry. The last point, yes, you're very right. If you do program for non-profit educational station, NFCB, Pacifica, you're not required, you see, to follow these very strict guidelines. But if you do for commercial radio, as I don't know if you have been in commercial radio stations, Jerry, but they have these tally sheets where every single record has to be entered there, how many times has been played, and then those tally sheets have to go to ASCAP or BMI for payment of royalties. It's sort of a clearinghouse for payment of royalties. So he's very right, you have to make a distinction. Now, if I do a program, okay, for educational radio, NFCB or Pacifica, okay, I can get things from the Library of Congress or from other archives without having to fill in those things. Let's suppose that 10 years from now, I decide to make a commercial record, very unlikely, but let's suppose for the sake of discussion. Then I will have to get permission from the label and so on for the record in order to pay the royalties, because I'm going to be doing that for profit. So that is a very, very important distinction. And the other thing, Jerry, you're very right. Sometimes I have some kind of, you know, friendly arguments with the people at Pacifica and NFCB, because I'm very heavily oriented towards classical music. I feel it's very important that we have minority programs, blacks, Chicanos, gays, women, but I don't want to sacrifice classical music only for that. The same thing I was saying, in simple styles can coexist with high-tech radio. I like sometimes to listen to those very elaborate productions, you know, with multi-microphones and surround sound, but let's not forget for that production that there are many other simple styles like the drop needle thing that we have saying. And in the area of classical music, let me tell you about Los Angeles. We used to have about 5 or 6 classical radio stations. Now we have KFSCs, it was sold. We have only one single station, KUC, left. And that's mainly what they call Bach to Stravinsky. Nothing before Bach, nothing after Stravinsky. So all of the other, it's a mainstream. Mainstream radio, classic
music.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what about those wonderful exploration of a Bill Mallet on the styles of Stokowski versus Bruno Walter versus the Furtwängler? Nothing of that is being done. And I feel the tremendous sense of urgency that young people have to be exposed to these black, Chicano artists, ethnic, folkloric music, as well as exposed to these great conductors, singers, operatic vocalists of other eras. I feel a sense of urgency, and that's why this panel is organized. Yes?
Well, the whole discussion of expanding the public radio system, I guess, started with this research that they did, this Audience 88 thing. And to me, what it has done is it has created, I guess, institutional standards of what classical music is. So you end up with the top 40 classical, just what he's talking about. And I just recently drove across country, the western part, to San Francisco, and I have to agree with you. In some areas, hey, if you could tell me where to find it in Montana and out there, I'd like to know too, because I couldn't find it. It was like not there.
No classical music.
No classical music. No, you know, it just wasn't there. And I think that that's what the whole expansion issue is about. And we have to remember too that like where we are down there in that non-commercial band, it was originally educational radio to educate people. And I think a lot of times we've gotten away from that and trying to reach audiences and everything. So that like educational is not educational anymore. It's like how to make a profit at that end of the dial, because it's a survival situation.
Alternative entertainment, and it's got to be entertainment.
Right, too. And I hear very little of the information that I guess a lot of you represent in here, having libraries and archival information and recorded sound. I don't hear it on the radio anymore. It's like it used to be on the radio. It's like a dying breed.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the classical announcing style, where you announce the composer and you announce the work and you stop there. There's no discographic information usually shared with the listener, and certainly they don't want to venture into any historical perspective. And it's not that the announcers don't have the expertise. Different elements to create a sound portrait of Kansas City: oral histories, music, and my narrative based on historic fact, and trace the evolution of the music from ragtime of James Scott and the brass band music of Arthur Pryor to Charlie Parker. And a lot of the people that were here when the Kansas City jazz was at its peak were still alive. They had good memories. I talked to Claude Fiddler Williams extensively, who was a member of the Basie band that played at the Reno Club. And I encountered something that I had never thought I would encounter, and that is discrimination, because I was going to use records. It was drop needle programming, not using sound recordings. And recently, this ugly little monster raised its head again. I was looking at a letter that was written by the director of our station, KCUR-FM, which is a public national public radio and an American public radio. You mentioned Bill Shapiro, and Bill Shapiro, for the past, I think it's 8-9 years, has been producing an immensely popular radio program called Cypress Avenue here in town. And basically what he does is he looks at American popular music, contemporary, rock and roll, soul, blues, and he puts it into a social historical perspective. and focuses on various artists, and he puts together some very interesting programs. And he raises more money for KCUR-FM than any other program except for Morning Edition and All Things Considered. But those programs are heard five times a week. His is only heard on Saturday night. And for several years now, he has been putting up his own money to send this up over the satellite. We are one of 17 national public radio stations that can that has a satellite uplink where we can send things out over the satellite. And in this letter, she was basically begging NPR to pick this program up because he could no longer justify financing it himself. And there was the little phrase in there, "I know you don't fund drop needle programs." And it is unfortunate and it's a shame that there's no source of support beyond a corporate underwriter. And if you've seen the Kansas City Views out there, there's an article where he's fishing for corporate underwriters for his radio program. It is the best underwritten program in heard on KCUR-FM, and my program, the Saturday Night Fish Fry, follows it, and I'm glad to inherit that large audience of musically broad-minded people. But this has become a crisis, and I think that the best way for archives to reach the public, and the safest way certainly for the collection, is to produce radio programs out of the archives on specific subject and have them broadcast. We have an opportunity to educate the public. You can talk about music, but when you talk about it and play in it, it puts it in another dimension. I personally have given up on trying to get anything over the network. I'm approached frequently and they say, "Well, why don't you syndicate your program?" And I don't syndicate my program because I don't feel the chances are good for it, even though it is an immensely popular program, and I just flat out don't need the grief. And I think that also it indicates, I think in terms of music, there's jazz announcers are known as DJs, or I'm known as a DJ in town. Larry Ruzick, our classical producer, is an announcer, and I think that says it all.
Tom Davis?
I'm Tom Davis. I'm a board member of National Federation of Community Broadcasters and sort of a radio pioneer. In the last 10 years, I've built and trained over 500 or 600 independent producers.
I would say more like 1,000. He's probably trained that many since he's been here in Kansas City.
But and it ranges from some very, when we talk about the history of drop needle programming and geographics, I'm speaking of areas where in the past there had not been access to the airwaves for some of these people because either they were not professional enough or they didn't have the training or they were just people who had a radio idea or a collection at home and they wanted to share them with people on the airwaves. Now when we talk about NFCB and Pacifica, they're one and the same. Pacifica was like in 1949, like Carlos says, was like probably the first time that individual people who had record collections, some of the record collections was collections of dead air or, but you know, we're all familiar with community radio and public radio and college radio and having access. And some of these people have like tremendous, tremendous archives. Some of the universities have tremendous libraries and archives of records. Now, we have housed now, we did have the NFCB archival collection, and most of it being documentaries. This collection was on the East Coast in Washington, D.C., in a U-Haul storage room. And in the Pacifica archives, you can imagine how much stuff can be archived from 1949 until present. It was in Los Angeles on the West Coast. So about 3 or 4 years ago, we merged these two libraries, and now they're on the West Coast, and Carlos is very familiar with the Pacifica Archives. I've just got a few brochures here of what that is. But the big problem still seems that even though we have these thousands and thousands of independent producers, we even have an organization for independent producers, there's virtually no support. We can't afford to support syndicated programming. And I guess virtually the arts people are more into funding these high-tech docudramas or whatever they're called. And so the plight of getting archived sound of music that's on disc or whatever, on tape or whatever, out and shared with other people in the public, it's an uphill struggle. Now, I know many of you have in your archive stuff that maybe only you get to listen to. There are other, I know at Ole Miss they have the blues archives. They have B.B. King's collection. They've got many, many. I could go in there and just walk for days and listen to much, much material. But to get that out to the public and get it funded or get money to go do that kind of research is impossible. It's just not there.
If I might add something, National Public Radio had what they called the Program Development, SPDF,
yes, Satellite right. Program Development Fund.
And it was to encourage independent producers to produce radio programs so that they could develop their network in that direction. And that was discontinued several years back because of the nature of the material which was funded. And these were a board of independent producers, but I think there's a real dichotomy between music producers and news and information producers, and it's very polarized. And they were funding things. One particular program that Patty Cahill told me about that was funded was something called Whispering, where they had a microphone in one end of a nation in a tunnel and on the other end, and the two producers whispered to each other. And just things that were not being picked up by the networks, by the member stations.
Yeah, you see, there's an infatuation with high tech in National Public Radio or the others. At that conference I went, I remember very clearly that the message, the dichotomy, that was 1977. And there you have this big time European producer with half a dozen recording engineers and field producers and so on. And the message was, if you people here cannot produce programs with these standards of technical quality, get out, you don't belong here. That was the message. We were a few of us from Pacifica, Charles Amirkanian, the music director of KPFA, was, and we dared to say we disagree with that. And immediately there was a quiet in the room, and from then on we were completely ostracized by the people of NPR. They were totally infatuated with all of the experiments in stereophonic sound, binaural sound, surround sound, and docudrama, and dramatic production with high tech, and dozens of producers. And that's what they go into. So this program, you know, that we represent, what they call the Simple Style, can they exist? Can we have support? So a few years ago, I have to virtually discontinue my program because there's no source of support. Virtually everything has dried up. And then, like Rick Ross will explain, there's virtually no tax incentives. And I feel this is the time for all of us to form maybe some group or some ad hoc committee to lobby for some changes where it counts. I mean, where it counts in the high radio circles of Washington, tax laws, Congress, whichever it is. So, yeah.
I have one more thing I want to add. Last year, there was the first, research study done. It took about 7 years to do it, and it was called Audience 88. And what Audience 88 explains is that, like, it's not because it was completed in the year 1988. It's because 88% of the people don't listen to public radio. And the whole gist of this is that they were mandated that they needed to like expand their audience or double their audience and diversify their audiences. And so what's happening now is that there's this whole discussion happening with public radio and its survival of how to expand it, how to diversify the audience, and basically what the definition of that is. And the important thing of it is, and I've extended to you like what Carlos was saying before, is that all of you have to put pressure on whatever your university system is to like have more than the demographic listener to public radio, which is the upper middle class white person who likes news and information and classical music. Because if that leaves out the many wide range of diverse listeners, and it leaves out the archives and the libraries that many of you represent.
Yeah, maybe we could go with Dick, and then I would like to end up, you know, with Rick, because, and then we'll throw the thing open to questions from the audience. What I feel is a tremendous sense of urgency. I mean, when we listen about Julia Lee or Bob Wills or dozens of, or when you hear Fred Williams, his passion for military music, I think he's the greatest collector of military and band music in the entire world. Or when we hear about William Mallock and his research in the musicology, these people should be giving a tribute to educate people, to enlighten people, because the young people, who of the young people know about the conducting styles of an Stokowski or a Nikisch 50, 60, 70 years ago to compare with the conducting styles today? There is Will Mallet. Who knows about Julia Lee? There is his program. Who knows about Bob Will? There is his, who knows about Duke Ellington? There you have Martin, and so on. But those programs are being turned down, rejected, not funded, and to hell with you. If you want to produce them, use your own pocket, your money, like Bill Shapiro, and we don't want anything from you. And my guess in these articles, I say, you can get a copy of all of these articles I'm gonna show you, is yes, it's fine. Let's find some of those very fine, dramatic production, high tech, but what about these simple style programs, which are very basically educational? We're not doing a hobby, according to the IRS. We're doing an educational labor that should be supported and subject of deduction. So, Dick, you wanted to say something?
Well, I do, and it's just from within the realm of my own experience, really, to try to answer some of these things that have been brought up, just to play the devil's advocate for the moment. I won't exactly try to defend public radio broadcasting, but nonetheless, there are some economic realities out there that have been evolving over the years, in the 21 years on and off that I've had association with public radio, for the most part just at the local level, although that may be about to change. But when you're talking about National Public Radio and all in the mid-70s, you're talking about a kid that that was growing up, that was big and tough, that had a certain segment of the radio audience that I believe it might have been you that described, or you or Chuck, I'm not sure, Tom, of the public, of the news and public affairs and classical music that became more or less the diet of public radio then, because it was listened to and supported by the affluent yuppies and so on. To some extent, that's had to become more the basis, because throughout the 1980s, the level of support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the level of support from the federal government funded through that that corporation has dwindled, and public radio stations have had to compete more and more with each other and with commercial broadcasting, not only for listenership, but for public support. And whereas I think the most conscientious stations still try to deal with intelligent presentations of minority or minority-derived music of all these genres that have been under discussion today, they still have to make money with that kind of thing. This term needle drop or drop needle is was a new one to me, especially as something to designate for discriminatory purposes music-based programs with commentary. Christ, I thought that had been the foundation of local broadcasting since the 1930s. You know, and I'm afraid it's very much what I do in Washington. Well, I don't see what's wrong with that. I think it succeeds on one level, at least I'm speaking personally, because I have a fairly successful Washington-based program that is exactly that. It's just it's recorded music and, you know, and more or less extemporaneous BS from me to go along with whatever it is I'm playing. Generically focused, but also on a fairly wide basis. But needle drop as a syndicated or widely distributed enterprise, I don't really know. We're about to try that a 1-hour version of my program called the Homegrown Music Hour is going up on satellite in July, and I'm not really sure how it's going to be responded to. People are going to have to find it two ways. It'll have to be underwritten, and that's not possible before it's actually uplinked, and it will have to find other public stations that want to support it. And I'm not really sure that people who have comparable programming possible in their own communities are going to find it necessary or even desirable to take that kind of program from national distribution. Let me hand this back to you, Chuck, because I see you've got some comments.
Well, I was just
going to
say, I guess that's the irony of what we're talking about is the local stations use drop needle programming for so much of their programming. For example, on KCUR-FM, we have jazz from 8 o'clock until 2 o'clock in the morning, and in the afternoons we have fine classical programming. And it's a major source of local support, and those are well-supported programs locally, but at the national level, they're ignored. And incidentally, Bill Shapiro's program had been picked up by at least 40 stations, and he receives letters, and it is really building, and he has just hit a roadblock regarding it. And they pointed out the fact he doesn't drop the needle in the groove, he uses compact discs.
We're going to have Rick now, because this is a very important part of the tax. And I find, you know, as I said, I feel it's a sort of a scandal, because according to the IRS regulations, if you are doing, let's say, top 40, if you are making something for business, for profit, you're making a profit. If you are a DJ doing top 40, which is very little carried of any meaning of cultural thing, it's just entertainment. You are subject to a lot of deduction because you are there for the money, for the business. So you can deduct your home space, your recorder, your equipment, virtually everything. But if this, we deal with Bill Shapiro, Chuck Haddix, or Dick Spotswood, or Tom Davis, or myself, we are clamped down, especially after the Tax Reform Act. Virtually all of the deductions work it down, and yet we see, as I say in this report, that they found out that hidden in the new tax law there is about $11 billion of preferential deduction for favorites of certain congressmen. So I feel this is a very sad state of affairs. So my question to Rick is to make a sort of a overall overview of this, or what's your opinion about changing the law, what tax breaks we have, and so on.
My opinion is quite simple, that beginning about 1981, when President Reagan took office, ironically, an ex-actor decided to take away the tax deductions and the tax incentives and the tax benefits from the art world. And that applies to all contributions made to various forms of art endeavors, not just public radio or radio in general, but to all contributions. Very simply put, when you reduce the top tax rate structure from 70% to 28%, the incentive for giving, for funding the public radio programs are taken away. If someone gave $100 to public radio in 1981, he basically gave $30 and the government gave $70, because when the top tax rate is 70% and you give $100, very simply put, you've saved $70 on your tax return. Today, with the top tax rate being at 28%, all you're doing is saving $28. The government's paying $28, you're paying $72. So it's become more costly for the taxpayer to give. And I think we have to look at it in this vein, in that our government is virtually broke. We're in a terrible deficit position. The Revenue Act of 1986 was construed to be revenue neutral. That means there was no money given up, and with all the changes made, the revenue coming in was supposed to be neutral. Well, if you take the top tax bracket from 70% to 28%, and that means that the affluent pay less, and you drop off the low-income taxpayer, it's the middle-income taxpayer that's always has and always will pay the bulk of the taxes, he's less inclined to give when he can least afford to give. That's number one. taxes are basically a very boring discussion, but I'll just tell you all a very simple fact that there's nothing fair about our tax laws. Nowhere in the tax code or regulations will you find the word fair except when it relates to fair market value. So don't look upon our tax code or our system of taxation as being fair. If you have a hobby, such as record collecting, and if you sell records at a large profit, you will pay the taxes on that profit. If you lose money on the sale of records, you get no deduction. That applies to your own home. That applies to your personal automobile. If you sell at a profit, you pay the taxes. If you sell at a loss, you get no deduction. That's what the tax law says. Getting back to what you were saying, Carlos, is the fact that, yes, in certain industries, there are tax incentives, tax credits, tax inducements for people to invest. In 1962, we had something called the investment tax credit that's been on the books since that time, and it's in a very limited fashion now, even after the 86 Revenue Act, which is an inducement for business to invest in capital equipment, and as an incentive to do so, the government is giving you a tax break. The oil industry receives tax breaks. One of the co-writers of the 86 Revenue Act was Robert Packwood of Oregon, and you better believe that the lumber industry in Oregon receives and continues to receive tax breaks. But unfortunately, and again ironically, an ex-actor gets into office and all the tax breaks for the entertainment industry, by and large, are virtually eliminated. So the only outlet, the only recourse we have is to bombard Congress and just advise them that we're strongly opposed to their turning their backs on the art industry, on the art and contributions to the art industry, and something should be done. Keeping in mind, too, while Carlos stresses that out-of-pocket expenses are basically what you're faced with when you're producing public programs for public radio, out-of-pocket expenses for charitable organizations are still deductible to an extent. If you have other deductions like home mortgage interest and property taxes and other types of expenses that as an individual you exceed $3,000 or as a couple you exceed $5,000, then your out-of-pocket expenses and your use of your automobile for charitable purposes is deductible. So what I want to emphasize here is that if you have an opportunity to produce or to contribute to public radio, do it. There's still some tax benefit, but it is minimal.
Yeah, we have some questions. I see a number of people who want questions. Could you please line up before the microphone, because it's important that we have everything recorded properly. And could you please, when you speak, please state your name, if possible, if you want to.
Paul Mawinney from Record Rama Sound Archives in Pittsburgh. I'd like to make a suggestion for anyone interested in doing independent programming. Recently, I put a program on in the Pittsburgh area on 8 stations in syndication with very minimal amount of capital. There's a way of doing it called bartering. Fortunately, we had a legendary character in our market named Porky Chadwick, who was well known in the 50s, like Alan Freed was in other areas. And we put him back on the air. And we convinced one of the stations that we would trade with them. They could sell half of the time and keep the money, and we would sell the other half and pay for the programming. And I was blessed with a fellow who owned a studio and a fellow who had marketing expertise. And we've been very successful with almost no investment in cash. So you can do those kind of things in your own markets if you have a situation where you know a style of music or a door opener, if you will.
Could you explain, we have some people here who don't know too much about the term syndication. Could you explain what it is?
Syndication, just simply mean, the way we do our syndication is we actually produce the show in the studio. It's not live on air or needle drop, as you were referring to. The person that we're involved with is up in years and not capable of being live on air, so we actually produce the show, put it on tape, and include all his jargon, and we actually deliver the tapes to 8 separate radio stations for each show. We're on 4 hours every Saturday, and some of the stations, you know, they're broadcast at varying times. They can run it whenever they want in a 4-hour slot. but it's 4 hours every week. But the station, we don't pay the stations a thing, and they make their money by selling ads on half of the show.
This is not public radio.
This is not public radio, but it's not really radio for profit either. My whole involvement in this project was to get Parky Chadwick back on the air because he was kind of a legendary character in our market, and I figured I'd like to introduce him to a new generation of young people, and the show's been very successful. We just signed another 13-week contract. Thank you.
Rich Marco, Chicago. I was going to bring up a similar point to Paul's, as a matter of fact, and was about just barely started looking into some aspects in Chicago. I don't know if it means quite the same thing. I was going to talk about brokered time, but basically my point is this. If we are and I did a show for 4.5 years on WBEZ, which is the public radio in Chicago. It's owned and operated by the Board of Ed, and you can imagine, even though they did okay by me up to a point, what that was like to deal with. But that did show me that there was an audience for my program, and I got tired of going on the begathons and seeing all that money go to pay Garrison Keillor and not pay me more. So I think that if there is community support for your program, no matter how limited, let's stop whining and stop bothering the NEA and everybody and go to the community for sponsorship and go to a station that brokers or barters time and get yourself on the air. If somebody wants to listen to your show, you should be able to generate some neighborhood sponsorships. And while you won't make any money, you should just about break even, and since you're putting it on a commercial basis, that should open up some things in the taxes. And that's about all I had to say. I think it's an area that should be looked into. Let's go commercial.
One thing I just wanted to add about the taxes, if you're considering doing work for public radio or any type of radio production and want to know more information about what is deductible and what isn't deductible, there are a number of tax-free publications. I have information. I won't bore you with all the various numbers. They're accessible. They're free of charge. They can be gotten from the Internal Revenue Service at any one of the three area locations across this country or with a toll-free number. And in fact, let me give you the toll-free number. It's 1-800-424-3676. And if you want some idea as to the types of publications you should be obtaining or where to write, if you have a long list, see me afterwards. I'll be glad to give you the address.
Number again?
1-800-424-3676.
Well, I would like to hear the comments of the panel on going commercial.
In fact, I just had a question from a person in the audience, and he wanted to distinguish between public and non-public radio. When we speak of public radio, we're talking about most of your college radio stations, the non-commercial 501c3 licensed stations, and their community stations and their college stations for mostly NPR, National Federation of Community Broadcast Stations, and their associates. And one thing that is really happening quite a bit now in those particular arenas is that many colleges are starting to defund their radio stations.
That's also important about commercial and non-commercial, Tom. It also has a sort of a unknown tie to access to archives. If you are a commercial DJ and you're making money, you are supposed to pay royalties for the recording you get, let's say, from an archive. For example, if I get a record from the Library of Congress or the New York Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hammerstein, if it's only, I'm always very careful to emphasize this is a non-profit educational aim. If I were doing that for CBS, for NBC, then the ball game changes because I should get releases and pay royalties for the tapes I'm getting, you see. So that's a very important consideration also you have to do concerning access, you see, and the intention you're going to be using the recording for. Let's go with the questions.
You know, I might add something on the challenge to go commercial. My predecessor at KCUR-FM, Lindsay Shannon, did a show for 7 years, and he was a radio salesman, and he decided to go commercial. And he's heard Sunday evenings on K-Fox, which is basically a classic rock station. And he not only does the show, he gets the revenues from selling commercials. And this is all fine and dandy, but A, you cannot, most commercial stations are not interested in the kind of programming that we want to do. B, I was driving out to the airport yesterday, and I was scanning the radio dial, as I always do, and I came across K-Fox, and they were talking about how their owners are going country on them. So bye-bye, Lindsay, if that happens, because they won't maintain his program. There's no security that like we find in public radio.
Peter?
Peter Bergman, with a correcting impression that was made at the beginning of this panel, and throw open a question to everyone here, the panel and the assemblage, for some suggestions and perhaps some help. There really is very little funding, if any, for original drama for radio. Since 1981, I've been on a committee in my hometown, small town of Manhattan, where we have a large talent pool. But we're thinking of moving the committee there. We have a large talent pool of writers, directors, and actors, and the production of a new play in New York off-Broadway runs minimally around $30,000. It shouldn't cost anywhere near that to do a one-hour drama for radio. In 83, 4, 5, and 6, we sent grant applications around. They were all rejected. And about a year ago, I was at a party and talked to Kitty Carlisle Hart of the New York State Council on the Arts, and she said that her feeling, personally, was that the radio drama was dead. There was no market for it, and NPR basically told us the same thing. The committee has disbanded as of about 8 months ago, but we'll happily get back together and provide wonderful actors and good drama if anyone out there is interested in having a local program.
It's just an abbreviated style of announcing that has become the industry standard. And you don't find it too much in jazz. In jazz announcing, they go the opposite way, and you always get some announcer in there that's a liner note jazz expert. And I know you've encountered a lot of them. I think you inherited one or two of them from me.
Well, conventional broadcasting wisdom says that if you do more, I'm sorry, I'm not using the microphone.
If you do more than a 45-minute spoken set in between music, you're going to start losing people because people want to hear real music instead of mouth music. So I think that's the reason for that abbreviated style.
Yeah. Yeah. Paul Mawinney from Record Rama Sound Archives again. 2 points to expand on what Carlos said. Most commercial radio stations, I think all commercial radio stations, have what's called a blanket license for broadcasting commercial recordings. So you're doing a show like I'm doing, you just make a log and show the publishers and ASCAP BMI, and that's all you're really required to do. You don't have to get permission from the source. Mm-hmm. You just provide it to the station in a well-documented format, and the station takes care of the rest by logging it, so you're not required to get permission to do that. The second point that I'd like to make, we were talking about public radio. There's an excellent way, if you have a strong archive or love of a certain type of music, to influence your market. Is number one, not only with your dollars in support, like Dick suggested, our archive makes donations to the public radio stations, but we also provide a tremendous amount of recordings. So we try to establish a relationship with the air personalities by providing the recordings at no cost. And you can have a tremendous input on the music played in your marketplace just by doing that.
Yes, I'm making it clear. I didn't say, you know, you have to, for every record, you have to ask permission to the company. No, you have to keep a tally sheet. If you use a Capitol or so on, yes, yeah. You have to have.
Yep,
but there have been some cases when, I remember, some composers, for some reason, they don't want their composition broadcast anymore. They find that they are inferior. Let me put you a case, Giancarlo Menotti, the ballet Sebastian. Many years ago, for some unknown reason, he said, I don't want this ballet to be broadcast at all. I don't like that particular recording. So he gave a circular, and BMI and ASCAP told all of the commercial stations, do not broadcast anymore the record. So you have to be aware of that. Yeah. Now, if you are doing that for Pacifica, like I was doing, you are not bound by that kind of particular commercial provision. So keep in mind, commercial is one set of rules, non-commercial, other set of rules, say.
Yeah. If I might just make a comment on that, at the Mars Sound Archives, one of the things that we have been doing is making the library available to public radio producers and public radio programming. For example, New Letters on the Air, which is produced by New Letters Magazine, a literary magazine, is broadcast nationally. and half-hour segments. And when it time came for Black History Month, Rebecca Preston, the producer, came to me and said, well, what do you have? And it just so happened that we had a record of Langston Hughes reading his own poetry accompanied by jazz musicians, a very rare record. And she used that in a broadcast and it received an overwhelming response. And she currently is trying to get an agreement worked out to where she can resell those tapes with the people that own the rights to that recording. And also the curator, who's hiding back there in the corner, Gaylord Marr, and I have both been on a program locally that's a talk program, the Walt Bodine Show, and for Armistice Day, we produced a radio program on the music and poetry of World War I, and they have received fantastic feedback on that. And putting things in a historical perspective, the next one we're going to do is Historic Voices. We're not ready to do a weekly radio program and make that commitment, but we have had access to the airways, and it has been very successful.
Good. Yes.
Don Wetzel from the Philadelphia area. I think the what's happened in Philadelphia this last year is an example of a lot of what we're talking about. Our local public radio station dropped a number of the programs that myself and my record collector buddies have always held dear. And of course, rather than just gripe about it to one another, I think we better gather ourselves together to what we do about it. One of the factors is when they're having these raising money thons, whatever they call them, telethons or whatever, make sure you take the bother to call in your own personal support during the time of the broadcast you want to stay on. Make your giving count for the kind of programming you want. Sometimes we just don't bother and we're complaining about what happens, and I think we need to take the trouble to do things like that. Also, another factor in the Philadelphia change was they had a new person come in and take charge, and that had the responsibility for what was on the air and what was not. And I think we have to figure out who these people are and find some ways of communicating with that. And as a block now, of course, there's a lot of things that we enjoy together and we support one another with that really do not have a genuine public support enough to compete with for the little bit of time that there is. And maybe we need to look for other media to exchange this sort of thing with each other, whether it's by recordings that are shared through mediums as ARC Bulletin, the Michigan Antique Phonograph Society, the New Amberola Graphic, where we make things available to one another and with whatever complications are necessary to carry that out. I'm reading the label on the can of worms, not what's inside of it. Sometimes it's complicated, but I think a lot of us would love to be on radio and express ourselves in that, and maybe that's not the place for our place. We need to be honest with ourselves about that, too.
Let me inject one further thought here, because I was talking to Rich Marco out in the hall a little bit, because I think in the confusion surrounding the microphones there, Rich's comments earlier kind of got dropped. And he was about to tell us about an AM station that he has located in Chicago. Small watt output, but of course that doesn't matter too much in a city that size of Chicago. You don't need a hell of a lot of power to reach a lot of people. AM radio, what has that become? You can't do an awful lot on AM anymore that's not in mono, because everybody that hears classical or popular music, current popular music, wants to hear it in stereo. And it's at some point, Rich, maybe you might get up and talk about what you were starting to talk about me when Jerry still goes, I'd like to hear more about AM radio as a possible outlet that we haven't really thought much about today. Jerry?
Go ahead. I don't mind standing, that's okay. No, my point about the permission under the copyright law, I understand, Paul, the licensing arrangements, et cetera, and yes, I did produce some radio shows in my own time a few years ago in my youth. Many years ago, okay. But my point was that most archives, most collections, if you walk into them and ask for a copy of a recording, and each archive is different, and everyone will have to speak for their own collection and their practices. You will have to gain written permission before they will make you a copy. Under the copyright law, there is a provision, if the institution cares to exercise the rights under that provision, that if the copy is for commercial, non-commercial purposes, they are not required, or if they are legally clear, they may require it, to make the tape for you without written authorization and clearance. It potentially, if you're talking a radio show of several hours and you've got a cut of 3 to 5 minutes duration each, clearly you're talking an awful lot of permissions if it's for a commercial program. I realize that then the station, if it's a commercial station, logs, pays its ASCAP, BMI license, and the money it's paid supposedly goes that route as well. But to get a copy for a commercial radio program out of the Library of Congress, you must bring me written authorizations from all of the rights holders of that material. I'm not saying it's right, I'm telling you what the practice is and what the Library of Congress's understanding and interpretation of what the copyright law says we must do.
Well, it essentially means that it can't be done, doesn't it?
No.
No?
It's not a matter it can't be done, it's going to mean that you as the producer or whoever is going to get the rights for you is going to have to do an awful lot of correspondence, because we require a written statement for the material you're asking for. Now,
well,
you can get a blanket.
Mean, I'm sorry, doesn't that mean in essence then that people have to go elsewhere for their material for that kind of usage? Or do you get significant numbers of those applications? It seems to me that that's almost prohibitive.
I'm not disagreeing with you that it is, but that's the reason I was making a distinction between public radio and commercial radio. That if you, for any request for a tape copy from the Library of Congress, you must put that request in writing. And one of the things that the written request form calls for is, why do you want the copy? And if the reason you put down and signed the request is the reason you want the copy is for a production on public radio, then no rights are required. There's also other occasions where no rights are required, as hopefully most of you know. But if you put down it is for production for a radio program or for radio production materials, hopefully the reference librarian will come back and say, what is the station or what is the syndication? And if the information is that it's for a commercial material, the response is you must unfortunately get the written authorization.
Let me clarify that. Unfortunately, there have been a number of cases of piracy, outright piracy, and that affects especially two areas that I know. One is jazz, the other is opera. And many of those records, kind of, you know, under the table records of operatic vocalists, are pirated. And they're obtained in a very, very dishonest way, you know. Somebody may say, I'm producing a program on opera, you know, give me these recordings. And okay, the person turns around, makes a pressing, and start producing all of these Nordic, you know, Caruso, Tita Ruffo, all of those. And that's very dishonest. We have to contend with the dishonesty of people. So in a way, I agree with the jury. But fortunately, most of the producers that I know are not that kind, you know. They are like all of us here. They want to educate the people. They want to go into non-commercial. For a long time already, I have completely given up any kind of idea of commercialization of my program, and I'm pretty sure that applies to Chuck, to Dick. We just cannot market those things, you see. Let's forget about that. That's what my intention here is. Let's change, you know, some other rules of the game, like NEA, more funding for NEA, for NFCB, so they can at least pay for it. I'm very happy, you know, to pay the Library of Congress or Rodgers and Hammerstein or Syracuse, you know, $50, $60. I mean, that's not a high price, because you have to contend with the engineering skills, the building use, you know, the temperature control. So it's a very inexpensive way, you know, to get material for your non-commercial programs. But that money, you know, that is peanut for most people, $50, $100, for us, you know, when the fixed income is a big money. And that's why I would like to see some funds raised for NFCB or NEA so they could subsidize some of our production, you see.
With
so
that much money, you could go out and buy the damn record.
Richard? Okay, well, I at the risk of repeating myself, and I want to explain some of the things I brought up earlier. First of all, let's define our goal here. Our goal is to get on the air. That should be whether it's NPR, APR, or commercial radio. Why keep second-guessing yourself and keep yourself off the air if, oh my gosh, if I broker time on this station, I won't be able to go to Jerry Gibson and get this record. So I just won't get on the air at all. I'll just keep bothering NEA and NPR and all that, and maybe I'll get on the air, maybe, for a while, before NPR changes its mind again and a new bureaucracy comes in. So the first thing is, let's get on the air, and then you got to run what you're